Hare Krishna. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So this morning we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, chapter 70, Lord Krishna's daily activities. We're going to cover texts 23 through 26. 22 to 26. So we'll chant 22 together. Tatra, there, Eka, one, Purusha, person, Rajan, O king, Parikshit, Agata, did come, Apurva, never before, Darshana, whose appearance, Vigyapita, announced Bhagavate to the Supreme Lord, Pratiharai, by the doorkeepers, Praveshita, made to enter. Taitraka Purusho Rajan Agato Purvadarshana Vignapito Bhagavate Prati Harai Purveshita Taitraka Purusho Rajan Agato Purvadarshana Vigyapito Bhagavate Pratiharai Pareshita Tatraika Purusho Rajam Agato Purvadarshana Vigyapito Bhagavate Pratiharai Pareshita Ladies. So I'm going to just read the translation here and read the translations and a couple of short purports through text number 26. Translation: once, a certain person arrived in the assembly, O king, who had never been seen there before. The doorkeepers announced him to the Lord and then escorted him inside. That person bowed down to Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and with joined palms, he described to the Lord how a number of kings were suffering because Jarasandha had imprisoned them. 20 3,000 kings who had refused to submit absolutely to Jarasandha during his world conquest had been forcibly imprisoned by him in the fortress named Girivraja. Report. Srila Vishvanatha Chakravarti points out that these kings refused the payment of tribute and other forms of submission to Jarasandha. Also, there is a well-known account in the Mahabharata and other literatures that Jarasandha desired to worship Mahabhairava by offering him the lives of 100,000 kings in sacrifice. Translation, the kings said, as related to their messenger, O Krishna, O Krishna, O immeasurable soul, destroyer of fear for those who surrender to you. Despite our separatist attitude, we have come to you for shelter out of fear of material existence. Purport. Sridhar Swami explains that the kings present their entreaty in this and the following verses. In this verse, they take shelter of the Lord. In the next three verses, they describe their fear. And in the last two verses, they make their prayerful request. Translation, people in this world are always engaged in sinful activities and are thus bewildered about their real duty, which is to worship you according to your commandments. This activity would truly bring them good fortune. Let us offer our obeisances unto the all-powerful Lord, who appears as time and suddenly cuts down one's stubborn hope for a long life in this world. Purport, Lord Krishna states in Bhagavad Gita 9:27, Yat Kuroshi, Yat Ashnasi, Yat Jahosi, Yadasi, Yat Tapas Yasikonta, Yat Tat Kurushva, Madarpanam. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer or give away, and whatever austerities you perform, do that, O son of Kunti, as an offering to me. This is the Supreme Lord's commandment, but people in general are bewildered and neglect this auspicious activity, preferring instead to perform sinful activities that lead them to terrible suffering. The Krishna Conscious Movement is working to enlighten the world about this most essential activity of loving service to the Lord. Om Ajnana Timaranda Shakananjana Shalakaya Chakshurunuritam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So yesterday, Radharaman Maharaj was giving class, and he's giving a little bit of a history about the place that the Brahman mentioned in our first verse today is entering, the Sudharma Assembly House. So much of Lord Krishna's activities at Dwarka were in this mood of him being a king, and his daily activities as described here are that he went to the assembly house and he did his kingly duties there. So I thought that we'd take a closer look at the assembly house and what a king does there, what Krishna did there, and what kings generally in the Vedic times did. Because you see, the assembly hall was the seat of government. I mean, everything took place there. It wasn't that there was a separate legislative branch that met someplace else, or judicial branch that met again in another place. Everything took place there, and the king, the monarch, was the dispenser of all law, all justice in the kingdom. And he did it right there in the assembly house. So every day, and it's termed that way, we get the word, he goes to his court. He goes to the assembly house, he goes to his court. Or people appear, like this Brahmin in today's verse. He's appearing in the court of the king of Dwarka. And so the seat of all government authority were these assembly houses. And so how important they were. I was just hearing this morning a little bit from the Mahabharata, and it was describing the Pandavas assembly house. Does anybody know what that, the Pandavas assembly house in Indraprastha was called? No, not Sudharma. That's the Sudharma is the one Krishna has in Dwarka. It was taken from Indra. But Mayadhanava built the assembly house for the Pandavas in Indraprastha when they were given that part of the kingdom and had to develop it, because they had saved, Arjuna had saved Mayadhanava from the forest fire. In gratitude, he built their assembly house. And you recall it has all kinds of tricky things. That's where Duryodhana thought the water was the floor, and he fell in and became embarrassed. Big thing, you know, when you get somebody like Duryodhana embarrassed. Especially where? In the assembly hall. I mean, again, it's the seat of all power. And he's embarrassed by falling, mistaking the floor for water for the floor in the assembly house. So it's significant where he had this embarrassing moment also. So the Sudharma assembly house in Dwarka, it's mentioned in a previous verse that there were six things that one got relief from when one was in that hall. And these things are important in terms of what they offer to a seat of government. I have a list of them here. I can find it. Okay. And the purport Prabhupada says, it may be remembered that the Sudharma assembly house was taken away from the heavenly planet and reestablished in the city of Dwarka. The special significance of assembly house was that anyone who entered it would be free from six kinds of material pangs, namely hunger, thirst, lamentation, illusion, old age, and death. How important this is to be free from these six things when you go and sit in a seat of power, the seat of government. These six things rob one of one's best discrimination and intelligence. And so it's not that it's just wonderful that these six, freedom from these six things was there, like a kind of liberation, but they were aids to the ruling the kingdom in a way that was proper and just. And we can understand that if we take examples of when great kings succumbed to these six things. Just like the first one here. It's the second one, but I'll get back to the first one. Second one is thirst. Parikshit Maharaj, as described in Srimad Bhagavatam, when he was on a hunting expedition, he became overwhelmed with thirst. He became so sort of mad to satisfy this pushing of the material energy, overwhelmed by thirst. And he went to the hermitage of Shamika Rishi. And when he asked for water, Shamika Rishi didn't reply. But this thirst was pushing him so much, he lost his discrimination. And what did he do? He became angry, and he took a snake and he wrapped it around the sage's neck, not realizing or appreciating that he was deep in meditation, and that's why he didn't respond. But he lost his discrimination based on this pushing of thirst. It became so overwhelming that he did. So therefore, if one who's in a seat of power becomes subject to thirst, then his discrimination may be impaired to some degree. And so therefore, the benediction that didn't affect one in the Sudharma assembly house becomes very, very important in terms of ruling power. Hunger. Well, on hunger, we have an example on the other side, and that's King Rantidev. Rantidev voluntarily was fasting, and then you know the story, one after another, being tested by the demigods, one after another, Malechya Chandala came and asked him for the food and drink that he was going to take to break his fast. I think it was 40 days or something like that. 48 days. And so he was fasting. So he was going to break it finally. But naturally, hunger in that kind of situation, what would be the reaction of most of us? No, I have to eat. And we take it for ourselves. But he was able to resist hunger and remain compassionate, as a ruler should be, remain compassionate, and even to those unqualified who came to take his last food and drink, he did not give up his saintly character. He was free from this driving of hunger. So how helpful that was in his kingdom. That it doesn't describe there about whether he was in his assembly hall at that time or in some other quarters, but he was about to eat, so probably it wasn't in the assembly hall, but still, I think you get the idea how important that is. So that's hunger, thirst, lamentation. How important it is to be free from lamentation. If Dhritarashtra was free from lamentation, we wouldn't have the Mahabharata that we have today, would we? Because he would have been able to resist and hear, not just resist, but hear the good advice he got from others concerning Duryodhana, his wicked son. Dhritarashtra, we know he's blind from birth, therefore he couldn't be the king. But he wanted to be the king, and he lamented that, "I can't be the king." But he also lamented, "Well, if I can't become king, then at least my son should become king." But what kind of son was this, Duryodhana, such a rascal? From the very beginning, he's advised, Dhritarashtra's advised, get rid of this son, he's bad. Then Duryodhana starts doing all kinds of terrible things, even from when he was a small child. You know, they were children, they went together to play in the forest, and Duryodhana and his brothers, they made a whole conspiracy to kill Bhima. Of course, Bhima was also kind of, you know, like beating him up all the time, everything. So those boys, there was always some rivalry between them. But killing them? This is, you know, Duryodhana's young boy. What to speak of when he got a seat of power in the assembly house, what he could do. So to be free from lamentation, which is the root of all that evil, is very important. The king cannot be subject to that because then all kinds of bad influences become part of his operation. So lamentation, illusion. We know that Jarasandha is a good example of how when one sits in a seat of power, one can be subject to illusion. And he was defeated by Krishna 18 times. Even after the first defeat, he was thoroughly defeated. All his army was killed, and he was left with nothing. And for a Kshatriya to go back to their city alive, especially without the army, having been totally defeated, that's already humiliation. But he was so subject to illusion that he heard from those supposed friends around him that, no, it's okay, you can win, build another army and go back again. 18 times he was subject to illusion. Obviously, that cost a lot of lives and wealth in his kingdom. I can't imagine how the citizens in his kingdom were suffering, because in the power, in the seat of power in his assembly house, he was subject to such illusion. Old age, there's a good example of how old age is the enemy for those in the seat of power. In the Mahabharata, in the description of when the Pandavas were 1 year incognito in the kingdom of Bharat. Bharat Maharaj was a little older, and he had a commander-in-chief of his army named Kichaka. Now, the fact that he was a little older made him dependent on Kichaka as the general of his army, because that's such an important thing. But old age makes us dependent in so many ways. And so Virat was dependent on Kichaka. And so when Kichaka started doing all kinds of outrageous things, insulting Draupadi, even in the presence of Maharaj Virat, he didn't do anything. Because he thought, oh, I'm dependent upon Kichaka. And if I say anything, maybe he'll get upset. So old age made him dependent. If you're free from that, then you can stand firm on what's right and wrong. But even Maharaj Bharat couldn't do that because of the influence of old age. Finally, death. We have the example of course, we know death obviously sort of ends things. But Bhishma, he was able to maintain things over generations in the kingdom because he was free from death to a certain extent. He could have death when he wanted it. So he had a certain freedom from death. And that enabled him to be the bridge while all the politics and the fighting went on between the different factions of the family. He was the one person who sat in the estate, in the assembly house, and made sure that things went on nicely. And so, obviously, the Sudharma Assembly House was a great boon because it offered freedom from all these things which impair one's judgment and therefore make the seat of power, the royal court, function properly. So, today we have the verse where we have this Brahmin, or a certain person, it says. Certain person doesn't say he's a Brahmana specifically. He was a messenger of the kings, but he entered the assembly house. And it's interesting, it says here, once a certain person arrived in the assembly, O king, who had never been seen before. This indicates that in the assembly house, or in the court of the king, there was a certain access that was there for the general public. It wasn't closed off. I mean, if a certain person just showed up at the U.S. Congress today and no one had ever seen him before, in other words, he didn't have any ID, he couldn't tell who he is, where he's coming from, do you think they would just let him waltz in? No, it's more controlled than that. And that's probably a good idea, I mean, given today's age, but still, there was some restriction to access. I want to turn to Chanaka Pandit, a bit, because Prabhupada quotes him, and give some idea what Chanaka Pandit says about what are the benefits of having open access to your seat of power. He says that inaccessible rulers destroy the people. Inaccessible leaders destroy the people. So it means that there should be some open access. And it says here, the next one is, easily accessible rulers please the people. Easily accessible rulers please the people. It's a big thing for people to have access to the court, because we don't read descriptions of, like we have today, so much media coverage, and that's how the public gets access. That wasn't present, access to the leaders today. We get it through the media. I mean, how many people can actually see they've ever seen the President of the United States? A sitting president of the United States. Have you ever seen him? I've seen a sitting president. I saw Nixon. He was about from here to the end of the temple. from me. No, closer than that, actually. Yeah, closer than that. But that's how many people get that opportunity to see their leader? Media gives us that opportunity, therefore we feel like we're really close to them. But in the Vedic times, this media wasn't there, except for the bards, which Maharaj was describing yesterday, who would describe the activities of dynasties one after the other. That's how people knew and heard. But this open access to the assembly hall, the seat of power, was the way people got to know their king. They got to see their king. They got to understand what kind of person he was by going there and seeing him. He did his business to some degree. He did his business in public. The public could come into the assembly house. There was this open access which pleased the people. And then they could see the king's activities, and they could judge what kind of person is this. Even yesterday we were reading about they had the joke, the jesters and things like that that came in, and they could see how the king was in different moods, not just his ruling mood, but in a jovial mood, how he joked with the jesters and things like that. You can tell a lot about a person by observing like that. That person, also the king, can show you how he's a loving person by sitting in court and dealing with things. Or he can show you how he's a cruel person by sitting in court and doing things. There's a section in the Mahabharata where it's a discussion between Bali Maharaj and Prahlad Maharaj. And it's about forgiveness or use of strength. Now, the ruler, especially when he's sitting in his assembly hall, that seat of power, he has the ability to forgive or he has the ability to use his strength to punish. And so it would be pretty interesting if you're in his kingdom to sit down there and watch to see how he deals with things. Because then you know how much you can get away with, how much you can't, right? And so there's this discussion between Prahlad Maharaj and Bali Maharaj about forgiveness or the use of strength. Let me just read a little bit of it here. Prahlad Maharaj says, "Neither forgiveness nor the use of prowess is meritorious in all situations. If one were to always forgive, then his servants, dependents, enemies, and even strangers would disrespect him. When one always forgives, then mean-spirited servants gradually steal away all his wealth and fail to respond to his commands." So a king has to balance these things. To forgive someone. Someone does some offense in court. Again, everything takes place there. Some criminal comes. He's brought there. King has to judge. Will he sentence him to death? Or will he forgive him? On the one hand, one who simply punishes and never forgives soon finds himself to be bereft of all friends. Indeed, everyone comes to hate such an unforgiving person. And when there is the slightest opportunity to do something to harm him, they do something to harm him. Therefore, the conclusion is that prowess and forgiveness should be executed at the proper times. So this is where you put your faith in a king, or you put your love. You love your king when you see that they can actually, according to the proper time, exhibit either forgiveness or strength. So Prahlad Maharaj tells Bali Maharaj that the following person should be forgiven: one who has done nice service in the past, even if guilty of a grave fault; one who offends simply due to ignorance or folly; one who is a first-time offender; one who has committed some wrong against his will; and in addition, other offenders may sometimes be forgiven just to create a good public image. The following person should not be forgiven: one who has knowingly offended and yet claims to be innocent, even if his offense is slight, and a second offender, no matter how small his crime. So this is what the kings did in their assembly houses. They sat and they judged these kind of cases. Of course, they did a lot of things. The jovial things that were described yesterday were there. The kingly duties, giving punishment or reward, sitting in court in judgment was another duty. There's an interesting history about that, because another thing that took place in courts was there was instruction for the princes and the new people coming up that would soon be there. It wasn't just that the king sat on that seat as long as possible. And it didn't matter whether old age and infirmity affected his judgment. He sat there. No, there was some training program, some succession program. And so sometimes the princes were given the opportunity to do this judging. And there was one such occasion when a murderer was brought before the court. Four persons had committed a murder. And Vidura, who was the prime minister of the court, and we're going to talk about ministers in a minute, but he wanted to test the young princes. And so he asked Duryodhana and Yudhisthira how they would judge these four persons that had committed murder. You may know the story. Immediately Duryodhana said that, well, they should all be killed, sentenced to death, because they took someone's life, therefore their life should be taken. But when Vidura turned to Yudhisthira said, well, wait a minute. First tell me, what caste are these different persons? And he found out that one of the four was a Sudra, one was a Vaishya, one was a Kshatriya, and one was a Brahmana. And then he wisely said that, well, they should be treated differently in response to their crime because they have different degrees of knowledge. Sudra, yes, he should be punished, but he should receive smallest punishment because he doesn't know any better. He has no knowledge. Vaishya, he has more knowledge. He's more responsible position in society. Therefore, he should be punished twice as much as the Sudra. Kshatriya, let me look at it, make sure I get it right here. Vaishya, Kshatriya is a protector of the nation and thus should not be killed. Should not kill people and make them feel unsafe. So the Kshatriya should get double of what the Vaishya got. The fourth man is a Brahmana. He's well versed in the differences between good and bad. His punishment should be the most severe. But you can't kill a Brahmana. Therefore, the head priest of the kingdom should decide the punishment of the Brahmana. Every person is different. You cannot measure every person doing in the same scale. That would be unjust. So if you were sitting there and you were observing this, you know, how much faith you would have in a king like Yudhisthira? You'd be willing to put your, not only your faith, but your life in his hands. And so this is what took place in the assembly houses, so that people could understand their king. Now, I mentioned ministers. Ministers sat with the king in the court. It wasn't that he was alone. And the ministers had a very important role to play. And so there's a few Chanakya slokas here that sort of emphasize this. One without an advisor has no certainty of counsel. One wheel does not move the vehicle. The true aid serves alike in prosperity and adversity. So there's some requirements of the minister or the advisor also. You can't be fickle, whether there's prosperity or adversary, you have to be there. One should not take into counsel out of love one who is impertinent. One who is learned and free from fraud should be made a minister. All things begin with counsel. Accomplishment of the task depends on guarding the secret of counsel. So ministers, advisors were extremely important, and indeed we're going to see as this pastime that we're just studying now progresses that Krishna takes advice of Uddhava. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, yet he took the advice of Uddhava before he started out on trying to execute any kind of plan. So ministers are a very, very important part of a ruler. And if one does not have ministers or does not take counsel, then that's a sign to watch out for. Be careful of that. Because no matter who you are, one wheel doesn't make the vehicle move. So with that setting, we have our person coming in today. And it's very interesting how it's explained by Sridhar Swami in the purport to text number 25. The procedure that's used when you go to court. Just like today, even today, there's a procedure. You just can't walk into court. If you don't do the procedure, then you can be thrown out of court. With the speaker of your client's case, can be thrown out of court. There's a procedure that has to be followed. Here is described that by Sridhar Swami. In this verse, he says, Sridhar Swami explains that the kings present their entreaty in this and the following five verses. In this verse, they take shelter of the Lord. In the next three verses, they describe their fear. And in the last two verses, they make their prayerful requests. So there's some procedure, some protocol you have to follow when you go into the court of the king. And as I say, even to this day, you can't just go into court without following the protocol. If you do, then you're out of order. The king and the judge will tell you that you're out of order. So generally speaking, the protocol is this. First, you take shelter. You submit yourself with some humility before the court. Your Honor, I'm here today representing such and such. This is kind of honorific, and we may not think of it as genuine, but it has a genuine origin that's right here. First, you express some humility. You take shelter. You have the ability to resolve my problem. Therefore, I'm recognizing that and humbling myself and coming before you. That's how you approach the court. That's how you approach the king, with some humility. And that's what this first, the last verse of today is. They say, people in general in this world always engage in sinful activities and are thus bewildered about their real duty, which is to worship you according to your commandments. This activity would truly bring their good fortune. Let us offer our obeisances unto the all-powerful Lord who appears as time and suddenly cuts down one's stubborn hope for a long life in this world. There has to be some humility in one's approach. And then one can go to the next step, which is to explain, I have this problem. I have this problem. And then finally, the third step is then you ask for the relief you want. And it's mentioned here by Sridhar Swami in the last two verses, they make their prayerful request. That language is still used today, probably more in England and following the British legal system than in America. But, you know, you make your prayer to the court. They use that language. You make your prayer to the court. And so that's the last step. First, you offer some humility Then you explain your problem. Then you make a prayerful request. My Lord, please grant clemency to my client. They have the authority. They're sitting in the seat of power, and therefore they should be humbly approached. It's interesting that this is the same type of an approach that we take in terms of kirtan, which is our way of doing the surrender, executing the surrender that this messenger is speaking of on behalf of the kings, recognizing the supreme authority of the Lord. There are distinctive steps in the process of kirtan. First, we pray to our guru. The Vaishnavas before kirtan begins try to express the same humility and dependence on the mercy of the Vaishnavas. And as Maharaj was mentioning the other day, not just singing kirtan, but the kirtan is the katha, it's also the bhajan. So either way, there's some in the beginning that one offers one's submission to the guru, then the Vaishnavas, and Shishi Gaura Nitai. And what does it constitute, that submission? It's different acts of sharanagati or surrender are mentioned there. And then Shishi Radha and Krishna. We find this in Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's bhajans as well. In his famous bhajan saranagati, you know there's different parts, and they follow this pattern. Dainya or humility, atmanivedana, dedication of the self, acceptance of the Lord as a soul maintainer, that Krishna is my protector, renunciation of unfavorable conduct, unfavorable to pure devotion, acceptance of favorable activities favorable to devotion, hankering for divine worship, hankering for supreme perfection, like that. It develops over time, beginning with humility, pridelessness. This is how we approach kirtan, same. This is our prayer. We approach in that way. And that's going to be fruitful. There's some procedure. And that procedure is established by the previous acharyas. So therefore, we follow them. And when we do that, we can be guaranteed of success. Because that's a seat of power. The holy name is given by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in this age. And so we can follow that. So any comments or questions on these subject matters? Yes, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, thank you for the class. Are there any tricks or tactics to fight inner pride or the ego? It seems like whenever you take on responsibility or any activity that can be seen by others, it's almost impossible to not have pride or the ego that gets boosted at the same time. And sometimes I feel, you know, it's such an inner struggle to have that come in inside your mind. And I feel like maybe I'm better off not doing so many activities if it's making me feel prideful.
Yeah, the other evening I was with another youth leader in our community here, and he was expressing the same kind of thing. He's like, wow, it's so dangerous that this pride comes if you're in a position of leadership, that you can make some offense to somebody, or that it almost makes you want to shy away from doing it. But that's the process of surrender. We know that there are dangers. Yet, we still try to do the responsible thing. Begging for mercy. Even Lord Brahma, when he was creating the universe, he had his prayers for creative energy are full of humble submission that he not be subject to pride and other detrimental things. Maharaj was explaining the other night during his Hindi class that the creeper of devotion and anarthas look very similar. So when you start in the process of devotional service, whether it's taking responsibility or just doing your regular daily sadhana, you get these very similar looking weeds coming up. So you have to be very discerning. So be discerning. Don't not take the challenge, but know that that challenge requires you that you be discerning. What is, and he was making the point, as soon as you see, you have to take it out. As soon as you see, oh, I'm becoming proud. You have to deal with it then. Otherwise, it gets stronger and stronger, becomes difficult to take out. So don't shy away from the service, which is very purifying, but do that service very carefully and be very watchful that you don't become proud. And as I mentioned to this other devotee when he was bringing this up, glorify and always look for the good in others. Instead of thinking about yourself, I'm so good, look for the good in others and try to fan that spark. Then you can protect yourself. Yeah.
Hare Bol Prabhu. The assembly hall of the Pandavas was called Indraprastha, I think, was it?
That was a city.
Indraprastha was a city.
Yeah, assembly house was called, I don't know, I was trying to recall that. Maya Dhanava, was it the Maya Dhanava assembly house? What was it? Huh?
It might have a special name, but I don't know. Anyhow, the assembly hall of Indra.
Well, he's going to say, what is it? Maharaj has the name.
Oh.
So usually it was known, no particular name, because since he had made, so this palace was known after his name, Maya Dhana.
Okay.
Probably something related to an adjective word, but something like Maya Assembly, Maya Bhavan, or something, his name is also there associated with it.
Yeah. Okay.
Not particular name.
Okay. Thank you.
To continue, so Indra's assembly hall was there was a description with a, I think was Narad and Yudhishthira, and he was explaining the different assembly hall because Yudhishthira was overtaken by his assembly hall. So he says, have you seen another one better than ours? And then he described Indra's assembly hall, Varuna assembly hall, Brahma's assembly hall. So with Indra's assembly hall, he said that it was like 100 yojanas high by so many yojanas wide and across, you know. So that's pretty huge, you know. If someone were to ask you, well, how that size is possible to come down? I mean, how would you logically explain?
Qualify yourself to go to the heavenly planets, and then once you get there, then you can understand or not understand. But we can't understand from here, from this world.
No, I was thinking. Remember, they brought it down to Earth, right? So I mean, if let us say a scientific force were to try to say, well, how that's possible? I mean, what would you answer them?
I'd answer that The descriptions that we find in the Vedas describe that conditioned living entity is subject to four defects. And those four defects affect our ability, just like the six things we talked about, you're free from in the Sudarma Assembly House. These things are affect our ability to see reality. So until we're free from those things, we can't make definitive conclusions about things which, you know, our intelligence, our senses may be impaired in understanding. So first, undertake the process to purify oneself, free oneself from those defects, and then try to understand, you know, based on a platform that you're better able to comprehend. And then we can talk about understanding on the same level. But we shouldn't discount things based on our inability to understand.
Very nice. Limited
so let's, we got to finish up. Bhadra, the last thing. Bhadra.
What we hearing 5,000 years ago, this was happening. And at present, it's completely other way around in the Kali Yuga. And you are in this profession. So these Supreme Courts, at present, when they make the decisions here in the United States, and it affects the thousands of people everywhere. So can you enlighten how this works here? I mean, this is what the decisions they are making is, are they affecting the, would affect in the future for whole generations of generations. So how this Supreme Court things works here, and what other precautions, like in the past, what we hear from the, what you're describing is, was, you know, it was easy to go talk, but in situation at present, how this works, can we understand a little bit, because you are in this profession?
Well, I had a discussion last weekend with Balavanta, Garuda, Brahmatirtha, and Guru Garanga. We were talking about recent Supreme Court decision on gay marriage. How would a devotee respond to that question if asked by the media about what do you think about this, whatever? And I think Balavanta gave the best explanation, so I'll just repeat what he said. The court is not making, first of all, they're not making a religious decision. They're making a legal decision. So they're not making them, obviously that legal decision has moral consequences in society, but they're making a legal decision that legally this can go on. They're not making, you know, a statement about the absolute truth, you know, spiritual reality or anything like that. And so we should understand the limitations of what they're saying. We, as the Hare Krishna movement, has benefited from a society that is an open society. We've benefited from that. We've been accepted. We're allowed to operate in society. There are countries around the world where, even today, where you're not allowed to operate and be in society and execute your activities. So we have benefited from that. So in one sense, if we've benefited from it, we can't complain.
We don't condone that. We don't accept that, you know, because
they made a legal decision. We don't accept it that that's something that we have to imbibe as in our belief system, or we have to sanctify by our religious processes or something like that. You know, we have the freedom in that same open society to maintain our religious traditions and our religious beliefs. So, yeah.
Our society, Srila Prabhupada has established, is about the bodily concept of life. Supposed to be. Whoever is, whether this or that, that is not the point. The point is that when the legal system establishes this law for the country, and that is whether ISKCON, forget about, not. Let's not take ISKCON society. ISKCON society is above the above bodily concept, supposed to be. Whoever they are, whoever is coming. But when you see the legality, when legally this thing is established, and it has effect on the whole general population in the world. So how this this well, whole thing works.
Anything has an effect on you know, material thing can have an effect on us. Not any particular thing. It's not any worse today than it was yesterday or the date of some decision comes down. These things can affect us. Anyway, we're in a material world. So how do we protect ourselves against that? By association of devotees, by chanting the holy name, by the vows of austerity, mercifulness, truthfulness, and cleanliness that we follow. This is how.
Yeah, but that is for the devotees. I understand that. But I'm talking about the general public.
We preach that in the general public. And try to give people the shelter of these things also. It's not just because there's some law that's passed that it has nothing really to do with anything other than the legal ability to do this or that. It has to change anything about our religious and moral convictions. The law doesn't do it, other than the fact that we should remain open and accepting and allow people to participate in our programs as long as they follow our practices. Anyway, this is a big subject, but we're already way over time, so I think we'll just end from there. Hare Krishna. Thank you.